This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org if you're not there already. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Dr. Alan Lockwood. He's Emeritus Professor of Neurology and Nuclear Medicine at SUNY Buffalo, and he's a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He was the lead author of that group's study on the adverse health effects of coal, and he's now turned that into a book called The Silent Epidemic, Coal and the Hidden Threat to Health. Dr. Lockwood, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm pleased to be here.
You know, I've never met you before or talked with you except in the 5 minutes here in the studio warming up. And so I'd like to ask you a few questions on your background so I can get a better sense of you and the listener can also. Did you always want to become a doctor?
Always. I can't remember a time when I didn't want to be a doctor.
Were your parents in medicine?
My dad was a microbiologist. I had an uncle who was a doctor, but I'm really the first physician in my family. My son is a physician.
And where'd you grow up?
Partly in Wausau, Wisconsin, and then just outside of Albany, New York.
Really? I didn't know you had some Wisconsin roots. That's
yep.
Interesting. And why'd you end up focusing on neurology?
I was intrigued by the nervous system when I was in medical school, and it was a place where there were very charismatic professors of neurology. And many of my classmates wound up becoming neurologists. So it was not all that unusual in my class to take the path that I did.
And how has the practice of medicine changed in the many years since you first became a doctor?
Oh, gosh, it's changed enormously. During my career as a neurologist, we've seen the introduction of imaging technologies like CT scans and MRI scans, an enormous change in the way the business of medicine is practiced.
None for the better, probably.
Well, some of it's for the good. So, I mean, certainly the improvements in technology and the availability of drugs to treat conditions that we only marginally treated, 30, 40 years ago, we've made enormous strides.
In cancer treatments, too, there have been some strides, not as many as many of us had hoped, but there's certainly on some things like some kinds of leukemia and some kinds of lymphoma can be handled pretty well.
Absolutely. There are now people who receive all of their treatment for lymphomas as outpatients, never go to the hospital, and are cured that would have died before. There are certainly still many, many things that can be done to make the practice of medicine better and do a better job. But those of us who've been doing research are doing that just so that end will be accomplished.
And so that remains exciting for you?
It does.
And what about the business end? Are you frustrated with private medical models of business health here in the United States as opposed to what Canada has or what Europe has?
That aspect of the practice of medicine is turning into a nightmare where in order to get reimbursed by various panels or insurance companies, you have to fill out all of their forms. They're all different. They all have different criteria. They all want annual reports and updates on this and that and the other thing. And so practicing medicine really now is much more extensive than it used to be. You know, you just don't take care of a patient in your office and do a procedure or write a prescription or offer advice. You have to have a cadre of some support staff to do all of the paperwork. And that's where an important part of the savings could be realized potentially by making that much more uniform.
So it's a lot more bureaucratic than it was. I know a lot of doctors are pulling their hair out about that aspect.
Absolutely. And that's why some people are actually being driven out of medicine because, they entered the field to be able to provide health care to people who would need to benefit from it, but you wind up becoming a business person and doing a lot of stuff that you hadn't counted on.
So what would you tell a young person who's good at math and science, wants to help people by becoming a doctor? Is it still a path that will bring satisfaction?
It does. Medicine is a calling, and I wouldn't advise anyone to do anything to change their minds about following the path of a calling, be that being a performer or a musician, as my son was for a while, or medicine, which is the path that I've fallen. If you're not happy doing what you do to earn a living, you've made a wrong choice somewhere.
So turn around and go back. I'm speaking with Dr. Ion Lockwood. He's Emeritus Professor of Neurology and Nuclear Medicine at SUNY Buffalo and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're going to be talking about a study he did for that group, which he's just turned into a pretty interesting and important book called The Silent Epidemic, Coal and the Hidden Threat to Health, that MIT Press has just put out. When did you get involved, or how did you get involved with, or why, with Physicians for Social Responsibility?
I was intrigued and introduced to PSR, as we, Physicians for Social Responsibility is a mouthful, so we usually say PSR, by two medical students when I was a junior faculty member at the University of Miami. That was almost 35 years ago, and I was told this was an organization that you should pay attention to, and I did. And as time has gone by, I've gotten progressively more and more involved with PSR, and now that I'm retired from the practice of medicine, I sometimes tell people this, I can't imagine how I found time to work because I'm so busy doing stuff. Most recently, the publication of this book, The Silent Epidemic, which has consumed quite a substantial amount of my time, and it's a joy and a part of the calling.
Well, let's zero in on that study and this book, The Silent Epidemic, Coal and the Hidden Threat to Health. Why did you decide to focus on coal?
Well, the title of the book begins to explain that. When you start digging into the epidemiology literature and looking at the huge number of people who die or are made seriously ill as a result of air pollution, you quickly see that burning coal, largely to produce electricity, is the most important source of this air pollution that's killing tens of thousands of people in the United States. So I would...
Every year?
Yes, every year. If we
people
were,
don't know that. Tens of thousands of people every year from the burning of coal in the United States.
Exactly, and that's the basis of the title of the book. You know, people don't realize that, you know, tens or perhaps even hundreds of thousands of people are dying in the United States every year because of coal-derived pollutants. So you don't see inhaling coal-derived pollutants on a death certificate. And most people, you know, they say, well, grandpa died of a stroke or a heart attack or had cancer or, you know, my niece or nephew suffers from asthma. And all of those are diseases that where exposure to coal-derived pollutants is a risk factor. But a lot of people don't recognize that that is, in fact, the case. And that was the impetus that really led to this first report by PSR and most recently the publication of The Silent Epidemic.
You know, we're all exposed. We must all be exposed to coal-derived pollutants because, as you say, coal provides almost 50% of our electricity. Are there some areas of the country where there's a higher density of this kind of pollution that more people are being exposed to?
Yes. Those of us who live in the central part of the country and the northeastern part of the country, where coal-fired power plants are more prevalent and are likely to be less well equipped with modern pollution control devices, are definitely at higher risk.
Now, what is it about coal that creates these health threats? Is it the carbon dioxide, or is there something else?
Well, it's all of the above. There are over 60 hazardous air pollutants that are released into the environment when coal is burned. Chief among these are small particles and oxides of sulfur and nitrogen, some of which contribute to acid rain and the formation of other small particles. But these oxides of nitrogen, for example, are what gives rise to ground-level ozone, which is responsible for health alerts that you're particularly likely to see in the summertime, where people with chronic diseases are advised to stay indoors or limit physical activity outside. The small particles are a risk factor for a whole variety of illnesses, including heart attack, stroke, asthma attacks. And there's even beginning to be some evidence that these small particles, inhalation of small particles, may be a risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease or type 2 diabetes. And we have a huge epidemic of diabetes in the United States that's partially related to obesity, but there's also beginning to be evidence that particulate pollution is responsible for some of this as well.
I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Lockwood. He's a neurology professor emeritus at the State University of New York, Buffalo, and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He did a study for that group on the adverse effects of coal, and he's just published a book expanding that, and the book's called The Silent Epidemic, Coal and the Hidden Threat to Health. I didn't know much about mercury either, and I saw that you discussed the threat that mercury poses from the consumption of coal. Explain that.
Well, burning coal is the leading source of mercury emissions into the environment due to human activity. There are some emissions of mercury that are a result of volcanism, for example. So volcanoes spew forth some mercury when they erupt. But there's nothing we can do to control volcanoes, and there's a lot that we can do to control the emission of mercury from human activity, and chief among those is burning coal to generate electricity or to produce cement. Those are two of the leading sources of mercury emissions into the environment.
And what has our government done to protect people from, you know, the mercury poisoning or the other poisoning that comes from coal?
The hero in this is the Environmental Protection Agency, in my mind, and the Clean Air Act in particular. The EPA, which was established under the administration of Richard Nixon and then modified substantially during the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, has the authority to control hazardous air pollutants from point sources such as power plants and mobile sources such as automobiles and trucks. And I think one could argue convincingly that the Clean Air Act will turn out to be one of the major public health triumphs of the 20th and the 21st century.
How many people do you think it's saved?
Well, as a part of the Clean Air Act, Congress required EPA to report periodically the cost-benefit considerations that are involved in promulgating the regulations of the Clean Air Act and the benefits. And the most recent of these prospective studies estimates that by the year 2020, which isn't that far away, the provisions of the Clean Air Act will save some 230,000 lives per year in the United States.
That's huge. That's as though half the people who die every year from smoking tobacco would be saved.
It's something like that, yeah. And the cost to industry for implementing the pollution control devices on power plants and automobiles and the like is estimated to be on the order of $65 billion per year, which is a significant amount of money. $10 billion of that would be changing power plant emission control systems. But the return on this investment in terms of improved health and not having to pay for people who would go to the emergency room for asthma attacks or heart attacks or strokes is on the order of $2 trillion.
So even on an economic cost benefit scale, it makes sense. And then you have the 230,000 people a year who are still alive.
Yes. We're talking about a lot of money, you know, a couple billion here and a couple billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about serious money. And there's a huge concern, and appropriately so, about the budget deficits that the United States has been incurring. But one of the ways to control this budget deficit is to promote regulations that clean up the air and avoid healthcare expenditures.
Well, how would you assess, Dr. Lockwood, President Obama's record on regulating the toxics that flow from burning coal?
Well, the Obama administration has been criticized, and rightly so, for not stepping up to the plate adequately. But I think in the political climate in which President Obama has to work, where the EPA is seen as a villain and the regulations that are designed to promote clean air are attacked as being unjustly attacked, in my opinion, as being, quote, job killers, unquote, have made it virtually impossible for the administration to do what it's capable of doing. You know, there's some really terrific people that I know and have met at the Environmental Protection Agency whose mission is to promote human health and conserve the environment. And these people are being demonized by the Tea Party people and the conservative right wing of the Republican Party in particular, and unjustly so, in my judgment. You know, I'm a physician, and so I talk about $2 trillion being saved, but I see these as people that I won't have to treat in the emergency room who come in with heart attacks or stroke or episodes of asthma. You know, I don't think there's anything worse than being a physician in an emergency room and seeing a mother or father bring their asthmatic child in blue because they're not getting enough oxygen because their asthma attack has gotten worse. And, you know, the parents are frightened, the child is disturbed, they don't understand what's going on. And many of these illnesses, you know, something like 1.4 million asthma attacks a year will be prevented by the Clean Air Act provisions if they're allowed to go forward.
My wife's a pediatric nurse practitioner and a school nurse right now, and she sees a lot of young asthma cases and has to deal with those, so I know how pressing
it's a serious problem, and many of those episodes of asthma, not all of them, but many of them can be prevented by assuring a continuous supply of healthy, clean air to breathe. And a lot of the pollution that contributes to these attacks of asthma and strokes and heart attacks and all of the other litany of diseases come from burning coal.
How liable do you hold the coal companies themselves or the coal company executives themselves?
Well, I'm reminded of the cigarette company executives a couple of years ago. I think there were five or seven or so of them who swore up and down under oath that they didn't think that cigarettes were were a serious problem. But, you know, the coal industry and the electrical power industry are very powerful political lobbies, and they look out for their interests, and they are capable and are spending large amounts of money lobbying Congress. But it's the poor people who have children who suffer from asthma, the elderly people who with chronic diseases who are at risk from the health effects of burning coal don't have a lobby. So there's nobody out there saying, you know, and spending large amounts of money lobbying their members of Congress saying, you know, we need cleaner air because it's a right that we have as Americans to breathe air that's healthy for us. You know, if that group of people were able to spend the same proportion of the $2 trillion that the coal industry is of the $65 billion, we would have so many lobbyists in Washington swarming over members of Congress and the president that they wouldn't be able to resist the cries for clean air and improved health.
But with the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court, why the companies can just spend unlimited amounts of money on that lobbying, so that discrepancy between their resources and the resources of the poor mom with the kid with asthma, that discrepancy is just going to grow wider and wider.
Yeah, corporations aren't people. I've never seen one in an emergency room with a stroke or a heart attack or with an asthma attack.
Yeah, that was the folly of that decision. I remember the Justice Kennedy saying that not only does unlimited contributions to in a campaign not bring corruption to our system, it doesn't even bring the appearance of corruption to our system, which is just one of the silliest comments out of a Supreme Court justice in decades. Tell me a little bit about clean coal. We hear a lot about clean coal, Dr. Lockwood. Is there such a thing?
Well, some people would say clean coal is a dirty lie. I mean, that's sort of a phrase that comes back. The history of clean coal really dates back over several decades when coal that comes out of the mine contains lots of contaminants. Some 30% of the stuff that actually comes out of the mine is in the form of rock and dirt and stuff like that that ought to be removed to make shipping coal to the power plants less expensive. So strategies for washing coal at the mine site, which creates its own waste stream, were developed, and that's the origin of the phrase clean coal. But more recently, that's been expanded substantially to the realm of carbon capture and storage technologies. which are a strategy that's being advocated highly by the coal industry as a source of unlimited or nearly unlimited cheap energy. But that's too is a myth. In order to implement carbon capture and storage technology, you have to revise the way the coal plant would be burning its coal to produce a stream of highly enriched carbon dioxide gas, and then trap that gas, compress it, liquefy it, transport it through a pipeline system that doesn't exist into a storage site, which would remove it and sequester it from the atmosphere for forever, geologic times, and do that on an enormous scale. I mean, trillions of tons of carbon dioxide are produced and emitted into the atmosphere every year by burning coal. And the thought of being able to sequester that vast amount of carbon dioxide safely and efficiently, it's a myth. And even at the best estimates for the efficiency of extracting carbon dioxide range between 80 to 90% extraction and purification. And that may not be enough.
So when we hear the term clean coal being bandied about, we should be suspicious.
Should be very suspicious, yeah. If it sounds too good to be true, maybe it is too good to be true.
The other problem about the consumption of coal is that it's not just happening here in the United States, but it's increasing in places like India and China, whose economies have been booming. And what threat does that bring?
At the present time, China is the worst offender in terms of the amount of coal that's being consumed and the amount of carbon dioxide and other pollutants that are being released into the atmosphere. But on a per capita basis, the United States is still far ahead of China. And the United States really has the resources and the technology and the educational system that's designed to support the research to move ahead into a sustainable energy future. I mean, all of these fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, are in limited supply. And in order to provide the amount of electricity that makes modern medicine and modern society function, we have to move eventually into sustainable forms of energy production. And that means taking advantage of wind and solar power, as well as making the way we use energy as efficient as possible.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today, Dr. Alan Lockwood of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's an emeritus professor of neurology at SUNY Buffalo and this member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And he gave a study for that group on the adverse health effects of coal, which he's turned into a book from MIT Press called The Silent Epidemic, Coal and the Hidden Threat to Health. Well, let's explore this sustainable energy future a little bit more, Dr. Lockwood, and we've got to do that eventually, you said, but eventually it's got to be pretty quick, right?
We have to begin, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. So this is the time where we need to be taking those initial steps in that direction. And we're beginning to see evidence of the growth of sustainable energy. I was in Michigan not too long ago where there's an initiative on the ballot that would calls for 25% of the power generated in that state to be from sustainable sources by the year 2025. So it's 25 for 25 is the catchphrase there. And across the country, there are places in Iowa that produce wind energy, and there's a great demand for that, and that's becoming an increasingly important part of the economy. In Pennsylvania, they make the blades for wind turbines, and the generators are made in places in New York. So it's becoming an important part of the economy and one that deserves support from the federal government, the way the oil and natural gas and coal industries has received support at the present time and in the past.
You know, one of the most horrifying things of the Republican convention was when Mitt Romney made a joke out about global warming. He was talking about Obama trying to heal the planet and make the rise of the oceans recede, and he got all sorts of applause, Romney did, and hooting and hollering because of that comment. But that Romney was just feeding the know-nothings there who don't believe that global warming is a problem. How do you, as a scientist, as a doctor, deal with these global warming deniers?
Well, denier is exactly the right term because global warming is not a hoax. There's very good evidence from four independent studies that shows in the last 40 years or so, global temperatures have increased on the average of about 8/10 of a degree centigrade. Sea levels are rising. Carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide concentrations in the atmosphere have risen to levels that are unprecedented in history, dating back to tens of thousands of years. So global warming is actually happening. And as it happens, we need to be doing two things. We need to be taking steps to mitigate that and prevent it from happening and adapt to what is certain to be a changing environment in the future.
Doesn't it make you crazy, though, the people who just deny the evidence? You're an evidence-based physician and scientist.
Well, it's a tragedy, and sort of denying the validity of scientific results and achievement is something that's unprecedented in the United States. I mean, look at the things that surround us. Without science, these things wouldn't exist, and everybody wants their cell phones and their flat-screen TVs, but you know, these are the results of scientific research and endeavor, and unless we commit to supporting science and education, we're going to become a second or perhaps even third world country.
I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Lockwood. He's the author of this book, The Silent Epidemic, Coal and the Hidden Threat to Health. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Dr. Lockwood, at the end of your book, you say you are optimistic that we will succeed despite the rise in these oceans and the rise of the poisons that are in the air. On what basis are you optimistic?
Well, I have to think that in an optimistic fashion. If I was defeatist in the attitude, I wouldn't be working as hard as I am to try to educate the public about the things that really need to be done to control this. We have it within ourselves as a society to address this problem. It's a question of orienting our thinking processes to accept the findings of science, to support the research and development that's going to be necessary to deal with this crisis. And if we do that, I'm confident that American ingenuity, which has been the lifeblood of this country and is what's made it great, will eventually lead to success in this field, just the way we've been successful in dealing with another variety of health problems, such as polio, smallpox. This is a health problem, and by using the principles of public health, by preventing the things that are impossible or difficult to cure, I think that we can ultimately be successful in dealing with this crisis as well.
You also suggest that the Earth tries to heal itself. That may be promising as well.
There's good evidence from observations of carbon dioxide concentration that are made on an hourly basis at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, that every year carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere fall very slightly, and that's due to carbon dioxide being taken up by plants that are growing. So if we can cut the emissions and encourage the growth of plants, there's a path for success in the future.
Well, I hope we all can walk down that path. Dr. Alan Lockwood, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks. I'd be happy to walk that path with you.
Excellent. Dr. Alan Lockwood is the author of The Silent Epidemic, Coal and the Hidden Threat to Health. He works for Physicians for Social Responsibility, which you can find at psr.org. I'll be back next week.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.